I was in a hurricane once, and it was a very interesting experience, and I want to talk to you about it for reasons that I hope will become apparent. I was living in Boston, and the TV started to report that a hurricane was unusually coming further north than they normally do, and that it might hit Boston, which they don't normally do. And it did. And it was a very rare experience. It actually, the hurricane passed over the top directly of Boston, and we went through the eye of the hurricane. And watching the TV and listening to the radio, they were talking about this horrendous giant storm coming. And people started to prepare, some people did. They were nailing up their windows and they were putting masking tape in X's across the windows and closing doors, and then everything went quiet. And I looked out the window and I went for a little walk, and the sun was shining. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. Cars were driving around. Things looked very normal. And I had a barometer in my house. And one of the things that happens when a hurricane's coming is that the mercury drops. And I'm looking at my barometer and the mercury's stable. Nothing's happening. And then at a certain point, the mercury started to drop. And I couldn't believe it. I watched this mercury because I'm sort of interested in weather. As some of you who know me well will know, I'm rather obsessed by rainfall at the moment. As a farmer, one takes an interest in rainfall. And if you happen to live on the East Coast, as I do, you take a particular interest in rainfall because it's so rare. But at that time, I was watching my barometer and it started to drop. And it just plummeted. It just went in about half an hour. And it dropped to the furthest I've ever seen it drop. And I was watching, so I just couldn't believe it. I was tapping the thing and saying, this has got to be going wrong. And then the wind started to blow, and it came from the south, and it howled, and it smashed Boston, and rain poured down, and then it stopped. And the sky went blue again. And I went outside, and I actually went and we live by the Charles River, which is the main river that goes through Boston. And I went and stood on the little bridge, the footbridge between us and the city of Boston, and the birds were twittering, and it was kind of humid, but the air was dead still, and nothing was happening. The sun was shining, the clouds went away. And then the most amazing thing happened. The wind started to blow from the opposite direction. And it smashed us again. And what had happened was the eye of the storm had gone over the top of us. I think what we've been seeing in the global economy is a little bit like that. We've seen some of the indicators showing the barometer dropping. And we've had some storm. It's been a storm in the financial markets, in credit markets in particular, and in bond markets and in derivative markets especially. And we've seen one part of it go over, and at the moment we're sort of in the eye. Because when you drive around Tasmania or you look out the window, particularly if you're on the East Coast, there's not a cloud in the sky, there's no rain, there's no wind. Life is going on apparently as normal. When I thought about what to say to this group today, I was sitting over there, I was looking around the room, and I realised that a lot of people here have heard me speak about innovation before. And I thought, what can I say that's new? And then I thought, well, perhaps the end of the world as we know it is new. I think we are seeing the end of the world as we know it. And as the eye passes over us next year, we will see an economic storm that moves from the credit markets into the real economy. And we should be in no doubt, this will happen. It will happen because the barometer has dropped and we've seen the first part, the wind blowing from one direction. What are those measures that make me so sure that we're going to see an economic storm next year that I think will be the worst of our lifetime? There's three I'd like to point to that I've been watching. One of them is what's happened to the Australian dollar. The Australian dollar has dropped more than any other significant currency in the world. It's dropped more than the Argentine peso, more than the Brazilian real, more than the Icelandic krona. If some of you know what's going on in Iceland, they're having food riots in Iceland, and the supermarkets have run out of food because all five of their banks have shut up shop, are bankrupt. Our currency has dropped more than the Icelandic krona. Why? What is the world saying about our currency? What do they know that we don't see as we look out our window in Australia? Or are they wrong? BNP Paribas, the global bank, is forecasting that the Australian dollar will go to 45 cents. Why? Our economy is still growing. We're exporting to China, aren't we? And they're still growing. Why would the barometer of the currency, a leading indicator, have dropped so far, so fast? And it is historically fast. I mean, we used to talk about currency movements of 2 cents a year as being the sort of range that you'd expect the Aussie dollar to move. Nowadays it moves 2 cents every night, up and down, mostly down. Second indicator. The Australian banks and the Reserve Bank has been held to be much more stable and much more sound than, say, those crazy Americans or those crazy Europeans. None of our banks have a solvency or a liquidity problem, supposedly. Why did, out of the blue, the federal government, the Prime Minister, suddenly issue a guarantee on all deposits in banks and on the foreign debt of those banks? Why? Because by doing that, the Prime Minister put a question mark over those banks and over those deposits that wasn't there before. What did he know that isn't apparent looking out the window in the eye of the storm? What was he being told by the banks? What he was being told by the banks is that they have to turn over $60 billion in foreign loans every quarter. We are the most foreign indebted nation in the world. We have a higher ratio of foreign debt to GDP. What we do is when you go to the bank here to borrow the money to build a house, you go into what appears to be an Australian bank. It's called the Commonwealth, or it's called the National Australia Bank, and you ask for a home mortgage. Or you go to Wizard Home Loans and you ask for a mortgage, and they make you a mortgage. They then take those mortgages. They don't have that money that they've lent to you. What they do is they take those mortgages and they package them up. And they create a thing called an RMBS, a residential mortgage-backed security. And they sell that to foreign investors. And it's an attractive thing to sell to foreign investors, or it has been, for two reasons. One is that Australians have one of the lowest housing default rates in the world. And one of the reasons we have such a low housing default rate is because we have full recourse loans here. If you default on your housing mortgage, they take the lot, not just your house, but everything else. In America, they have non-recourse loans, mostly. If you default on your home mortgage, they can't go after all the other assets that you own. So people default much more, because it's much less financially devastating to an individual. We have full recourse loans, and we have higher interest rates. And so long as our currency is stable, you can keep the game going. The banks and the home loan operations lend the money to people, and they take it, they package it, they sell it to foreign investors, and we import capital to build our houses, to buy and trade houses, to have one of the highest or most overpriced property markets in the world, and we import the capital to invest in businesses. And it all works so long as foreigners want to keep lending us the money. And that will happen so long as they think our currency is stable, that we can pay it back, and that our interest rates are higher. But what happened 6 weeks ago was that the big four Australian banks told the Prime Minister that the global capital markets were saying to them, we will not roll over your loans unless you make it sovereign debt. It has to be government debt, effectively. So you need, because they're guaranteeing the loans in Europe and America, you need to have yours guaranteed by the government or we won't roll over the debt. And if we don't roll over the debt, what happens? Your investment market implodes. Some of the banks don't just have a question mark over them, they become insolvent and the currency drops off a cliff. So you have to guarantee it. So the Australian government has guaranteed those loans. Australian government's gone from basically a zero debt position to being one of the most indebted governments in the world overnight as a result of a single decision that they were essentially forced to make. That's not their debt, but they've guaranteed it. It's like if my brother, and some of them, you who know my brother will know he does this sort of thing, if he says, will you guarantee my debt, and I sign up and say, yes, I will, that's not my debt, it's my brother's debt. Except if he defaults, they do come after me. That's what a guarantee is. So it's effectively on my balance sheet. The bugger. A third indicator, a barometer that I keep pinging and seeing can't be happening, can't look like that, is I have a strong interest in the trading of agricultural commodities. And a really leading indicator in the trading of agricultural commodities is forward freight rate contracts. How boring can you get? Forward freight rate contracts. And there's two basic units that you use for global freight trading in big units. One's called a Cape vessel and one's called a Panamax. A Panamax is the biggest ship that can pass through the Panama Canal, and a bigger vessel is called a Cape because it goes around the Cape of Good Hope. Forward contracts for Cape vessels in the last 3 months have dropped 93% in value. 93%. And Panamaxes have dropped 97%. We've never seen this. Nobody's ever seen that happen. The price of the forward price of freight has dropped by 97%. What could possibly be causing that? That is a real number. What's happening is that no one is willing to commit 3 months ahead to leasing a ship, to moving their commodity, because they don't know what the market is going to be. They don't know if anyone's going to buy what they're selling. Even the most fundamental commodities like soybeans and corn, which you have to eat. Many countries rely upon imported food to survive. The forward rates for shipping that stuff have dropped 97% because people don't know if they're going to be a customer there at all. One of the reasons they don't know whether there's going to be a customer there is because to do that deal you need a thing called an LC, a letter of credit. Somebody has to guarantee the transaction and they have to take the risk, the credit risk on it. And nobody's issuing letters of credit. So we've got three barometer readings that are just off the charts. We've never seen this sort of thing happening before, at least in my lifetime. You go back and you read about things that happened at the time of the establishment of the British East India Company, where they had global crises like this. But in my lifetime, we've never seen anything like these changes in the numbers, the dials that you look at to try to understand what's happening in the global economy. I know we were told that it's very difficult to predict the future. I'll make a prediction here, and I hope the hell I'm wrong. I believe in the coming year, the Australian federal government will be put on downgrade watch as a borrower by the international ratings agencies, Standard and Poor's. What that means is Australia's AAA credit rating will be in jeopardy, because it's gone from having zero debt to guaranteeing one of the largest foreign debts in the world as a ratio to GDP. Now, if we go on downgrade watch and lose the AAA, or risk losing the AAA credit rating, the consequences of that will be unprecedented. And not the least of them will be an implosion of investment in Australia and an implosion of the Australian dollar. Why am I talking about all this stuff when I'm supposed to be talking about innovation? The reason is that as we think about an innovation strategy and a development strategy for Tasmania, looking forward for 2 years, we have to think about it in the context of the hurricane that is going to come when the eye passes over us and it hits the real economy, when the wind changes direction and it comes into the real economy. We have to think about what it means to have an innovation strategy for Tasmania in that context. And these dials are saying we are heading into unprecedented economic turmoil. What are the implications of that for an innovation strategy and for a development strategy for Tasmania? To understand that, we have to look at where our relatively good economic performance of the past 10 years has come from, and see how much will that be affected by a credit crisis or a dollar crisis. What's happened in Tasmania in the last 10 years is really, compared to what we've done historically, impressive. Our gross state product has gone, according to the latest figures, from $16.952 billion in 1999 to $20.9 billion this year. 16.952 to $20.907 billion. That's an increase of 23%. And that's been our good economic performance. That's transformed the way Tasmania feels as a society and transformed its prosperity. It feels positive and optimistic and outward looking, and it feels like the sort of place where you want to return home and live there and be part of it, and you want to invest. 23% growth. How did we do that? And how much will the factors that produce that be affected by the coming hurricane? Well, the big number that increased is a thing called total final consumption expenditure. That went from 13.0 billion to 17.3 billion, an increase of 33%. 23% growth state product growth, 33% growth in consumption. If you look at the investment part, if you think of the economy as consumption plus investment plus trade, when you look at the investment part, the big number that's changed over those 10 years is dwellings, which went from 750 million to 1.34 billion, an 80% increase. Think about those two things. What's really changed in Tasmania is consumption spending and private house building. There's also been some significant investment in retail building and some significant investment in the import of machinery. Our economy, if you take a very interesting ratio, gross fixed capital formation, read investment, as a proportion of the total economy, it's 19.9%. In other words, our economy is 80% consumption. That's one of the highest ratios I've ever seen, 80% consumption. China has about 40% consumption and 60% investment. And we have 80% consumption and 19.9% investment in our economy. So we can conclude the big drivers of Tasmanian prosperity over the last decade have been an increase in consumption expenditure and an increase in private dwellings. Why did they increase? I think they increased because we're narrowing the gap with the mainland. The gap between Tasmania spending and house prices and the mainland got so great that people started to cross over. They started saying, why would I buy a house in Sydney to rent at 0.2% return when I can buy a house in Tasmania to rent at 12% return? We did in fact have that sort of gap at one point. Why would I try to live in an $800,000 house in the western suburbs of Sydney with one bathroom and three crappy bedrooms when I could, with $800,000 in Hobart, I could live in a mansion like you guys live in? So we started to have arbitrage. People started to bring their capital from the mainland, just a bit, didn't like bankrupt the mainland, but bringing that capital from the mainland to here and people moving along with it reversed the demographics and it reversed the investment. At the same time, wages began to catch up a little bit with the mainland, and as the value of people's house went up, they borrowed more and they used that to spend on consumption. Note, our good economic performance has been highly dependent on debt-driven consumption and debt-driven house price increases. And what's the world doing? It's shutting off debt. Yeah, that's a bit of a worry. Now, if you look at what we produce to sell to the world, because you don't sell houses to the world, you kind of live in those or rent them to each other. If you look at what we produce to sell to the world with real assets that produce something the world wants, what's happened there over the last 10 years? Well, export of goods, and that's not a very good measure for Tasmania because it's export out of Australia, not export out of Tasmania to the real foreigners, the mainlanders. But export of goods, it's the best proxy that I could find quickly, has gone from 3.36 billion to 3.7 billion in 10 years. That's an increase of about 1% per year. Now, note that that's taken place, so it's much lower than any other number on my sheet. It's close, I mean, if you draw that as a line, it looks pretty much flat. That's taken place during the greatest resources boom we've ever seen. When the price of all the stuff we're supposed to be selling, like zinc and aluminium, has been at historic highs. So during the greatest export resources boom of all time, Tasmania over 10 years has managed a 12% increase in what we sell to the world. Again, the conclusion would be that we're having prosperity not because we've gotten better at producing stuff the world wants to buy, but we've gotten better at having high housing prices, and we've gotten a lot better at going to Harvey Norman and putting stuff on the credit card. Put these two things together. We've had a consumption and a debt-driven period of prosperity. Let's not call it a boom. It's not a boom. Period of prosperity. And we've got an economic hurricane coming which will be characterized by massive deleveraging, reduction of debt, reduction of investment, reduction of expenditure, and the shutting down of certain credit markets. And the conclusion to my mind is the Mercury's wrong. Now that may come as a shock to you that the Mercury could be wrong. But on the front page of the Mercury, And I know they're not here because I asked that they not be allowed into the room. But on the front page of the Mercury in the last week, we've had these stories saying Tasmania's exempt. You know, numbers are still looking good. The barometer hasn't dropped yet for Tasmania. But if we have been having a consumption and a debt-driven period of prosperity, and credit markets are shutting down and the world's willingness to lend to us is in jeopardy, then Tasmania is very vulnerable. What should we do about that? And this is where we finally come, and you'll be glad to know, to the topic of my speech, which is innovation. As a result of this economic crisis, the former paradigms of how we think about the role of government in the economy have been shattered. The deregulation, let the markets take care of everything, get out of the way and the world will boom, counterparty risk will assure responsible lending. A lot of these sort of mantras of the 1980s and 1990s have been destroyed by what's happened. Governments will re-regulate financial markets, there's no doubt about that, and governments will begin to invest heavily. They will take on debt. They will stand in for private credit markets. And they will be under political pressure, as indeed they are today in Australia, to take up the slack, to keep the economy moving. Kevin Rudd announces $10.4 billion to be put into the economy in one lump as a check going to not to me, unfortunately, but to most other citizens in December, which will result in a one-time spike upwards in our imports of Xboxes and plasma TVs and dishwashers, and a big spike up in the amount of alcohol consumption during the Christmas period. $10.4 billion, and there goes the federal government surplus. The way we thought about the role of government in the economy has been transformed, and more so elsewhere than in Australia. What we will see is governments saying we have to make things happen in the economy. We have to spend money, we have to build, make jobs happen, and make consumption happen. The risk is that without deep thinking about what are we trying to do with that and what will be left over afterwards, we'll fritter that away. Governments will take on the debt, will go into deficit and pump the money into the economy, and in 6 months' time it'll be gone. And everyone will have a plasma TV, and then wait 2 years and you'll be able to pick it up at the curbside as people have tossed it out when they get a new one. In Tasmania we have the choice of being passive as that happens and we waste that money, we waste that opportunity, or we have, I believe, a historic opportunity to take advantage of these circumstances, to invest to increase the productive capacity of our economy for the long term, to create some real assets that will enable us to sell something the world wants. The money will become available. You know, we actually have the federal government calling the state government and saying, what do you got that we can spend money on? That never happens. They're looking to find opportunities to inject capital into the economy. We have, I think, now a historic opportunity equivalent to what we had in the 1920s to transform the Tasmanian economy by increasing its productive capacity through innovation. What we did in the 1920s is we had a vision about what Tasmania could be, taking its key assets, its key resources, reconfiguring them, rearranging them, putting them together, and building new industries and creating new products and selling to the world. We called it hydro-industrialisation. It was an innovation strategy. We didn't just turn the lights on in our houses. We created a massive surplus of cheap electricity by using our abundant water supply, and we used that to attract industry that transformed our economy. It's difficult to imagine what Tasmania looked like before hydro-industrialisation. It was as close to a third world economy as you could want to see. The majority of people in Tasmania were essentially subsistence farmers, living in houses with dirt floors, with virtually no industrial or manufacturing jobs. And an innovation vision, hydro-industrialisation, used the abundance of water to create cheap electricity and use that cheap electricity to attract industry to Tasmania, transformed our society and created the Tasmania that we live in today. That vision petered out in the late 1970s and was terminated by the High Court's decision of 1983 to prevent the construction of the Gordon Bilo Franklin Dam. Since 1983, we've been fumbling around in Tasmania looking for a new economic mainspring, something that can, again, create a vision of what our society could be, that isn't just a string of unconnected projects, many of which pit one Tasmanian against another, brother against brother within families, arguing about the environment. We've looked for ways that government can inject some money in the economy to make some things happen, and we've hoped that we can win a couple of projects, thinking at random like a pulp mill, that will reinvigorate our economy. But all of them have split us down the middle, with roughly 50%, whether it's 40%, 60% on one side or the other side. And we haven't had a shared vision of what the economic mainspring could be. I think we now stand at a point where we have the need for such a vision, and we have a government that could deliver it, and we have potentially the capital becoming available to create a new economic mainspring. Now, what would that be? In my view, what that would be is an industry, or a series of connected industries, probably a better way of expressing it, that are able to leverage what's happening in the world and take advantage of the resources and capabilities and assets that we have in Tasmania to match what the world needs with what we can do. What we have still today is a superabundance of water, an abundance of arable land, very high quality farmers, good research institutions. We could have in Tasmania, I like to call my proposed strategy, no one's taken it up yet, my proposed strategy hydro-agrarianisation. We could use the water and the land and the people and the research and the brand and the image of what Tasmania is to create a set of food and agribusiness related assets that would produce high quality, highly desirable, valuable products to sell to the world. Is this realistic? Could we do it? I think we could add to each of five categories of food or other product $1 billion in sales. We could make each of five food and agribusiness related sectors a $1 billion industry. Remember that our total exports are currently 3.7 billion. So I'm saying we could add 5 billion to that in just five food sectors. What are those? Those are beef, dairy, including cheese, horticulture, apples, cherries, apricots, olives, poppies, wine, and aquaculture. Each of those, in my view, could become a $1 billion sales business over 10 years. By combining our water, our sunlight, our land, the skills of our researchers, and the skills of our farmers. I'm not predicting that this will happen. In fact, I'd be willing to predict that absent a huge change in the way Tasmania thinks about these resources and what we do to put them together, it won't happen. Just as hydro-industrialisation didn't happen by itself, the water didn't suddenly create turbines for itself to go through. Those had to be created by a vision and by investment and by planning and thinking and community discussion and by engineering and by people who made it happen against every obstacle. It isn't automatic, and I'm not predicting that these sectors are just going to grow. In fact, I predict that they're not going to grow unless we reconfigure, we innovate in the way we put these elements together. I'll give you an example of the potential and what's required to do it. The wine industry. Tasmania currently has 1,300, roughly, hectares of wine grapes. The average price of Tasmanian wine is $29 a litre. Give you some sense of where that stands. The average price of Australian wine is $3.40 a litre. When we sell Australian wine to the world, the average price we get is $3.40 a litre. In Tasmanian wine, we get $29 a litre. Why? Because it's vastly superior quality. Why? Because it's cool climate, high latitude. Cool climate, high latitude gives it an ability to be much higher quality, managed properly. But we only have 1,300 hectares. Some sense of scale. The Australian wine industry is about 2% of the world's wine production. Australian wine, 2% of the world. Tasmania, 0.2% by volume of Australia's production, 0.2%. 0.2% of 2%. 1,300 hectares. If you use your land to produce wool, which is mostly what we do with our arable land, we produce wool, you can, in a good year, expect about $40 per hectare net income. If you use your land to produce beef, I'm not talking about Wagyu beef, I'm talking about regular Tasmanian beef, you get about $100 a hectare in a good year. Dairy, about $1,000 a hectare. Horticulture, between $4,000 and $15,000 a hectare, depending on what you're growing. Wine, $25,000 a hectare. Now, think about that. $25,000 a hectare to the grape grower currently is what we're getting for our wine grapes. It's estimated that we have 20 to 30,000 hectares of land that could grow super premium wine grapes. Super premium, $30 a bottle and above. 1,300 hectares in total, probably 1,000 of that is actually in the right place. Let's be generous. But we could have 20 to 30,000 hectares. But that 20 to 30,000 hectares, by and large, is producing wool. If we had 20,000 hectares at $20,000 a hectare net income to the grower, that's $400 million. If you add that to that, the production and distribution and the tax on top of it, you've got a $1 billion industry. Just in wine. If we had 25,000 hectares of wine grapes in Tasmania turned into wine, by value, the Tasmanian wine industry would be roughly the same size as the Australian wine industry. It's a huge opportunity. And you can go through category by category and say, if we transitioned our land use from wool to beef to dairy to horticulture to wine, we would create value of the sort of scale I'm talking about. But to do that, we need to invest substantially. We need to train our people in a different way. At the moment, it's not possible to study farm management in Tasmania. You can in Australia. You can't study farm management in Tasmania. It's our most important industry. It's the industry in which we are most concentrated, which is disproportionately represented, and you can't study farm management in Tasmania. You can study agricultural science or agronomy, but not how to manage a farm as an entrepreneurial business. We need to train our people how to do this. I don't have, of course, the time to go into the detail of how to realise this vision, but I want to finish by painting a picture of what it would do to Tasmania to transform our society in this way. I think we could become analogous to Provence in France or Tuscany in Italy, a place with a fantastic lifestyle, with a thriving tourism and agricultural industry and food production industry, with a name for a quality of life and a great place to live and a quality of product that was world renowned. Surprisingly, or interestingly, both those places are on the same latitude that we are. They're just in the northern hemisphere, we're in the southern hemisphere. Provence is about 40 degrees south, Tuscany is about 40 degrees north, sorry, and Tuscany is about 40 degrees north. We have this very similar conditions. If we did this, all regions of Tasmania would benefit. Most of the benefit would be in the north, but the south would get plenty of advantage as well. All the income strata of our society would benefit. We would create unskilled jobs, and we'd create research jobs, and we'd create entrepreneurship opportunities, and we'd create management opportunities in dozens or hundreds of small companies or medium companies, and hopefully a few big ones, owned and managed by Tasmanians. We would create an economic basis for the sort of life we want to lead that was sustainable and that wasn't debt-driven. And the amazing thing about this is that the very fact that we're about to have the worst economic crisis of our life may create the opportunity for us to do exactly this, to make these investments and to make this happen, in the same way that the crisis of the 20s and 30s created the opportunity to transform Tasmania with hydro-industrialisation. Thanks.